From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Andrew Vax writes crime novels about an ex-con, scam artist, and unlicensed private eye. As for Vax, he works within the system fighting crime. He's a lawyer specializing in child abuse cases. On today's Fresh Air, Vax talks about the underworld in fact and fiction. Also today, we meet rock impresario Malcolm McLaren. In the 70s, he created the British punk band The Sex Pistols. That's just one of McLaren's accomplishments under examination in an exhibit at New York's New Museum of Contemporary Art. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward is back, this time with a profile of the eccentric Captain Beefheart. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Great Divide, Studs Terkel's latest collection of interviews. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Andrew Vax's work has exposed him to shocking stories. He's a lawyer in New York City, specializing in child abuse cases. Many of the children he represents are victims of physical abuse, incest, or pedophilia. Vax also writes crime fiction. His stories are informed by his encounters with the abusers he calls the maggots. The main character in Vax's novels is an orphan, ex-con, scam artist, and unlicensed private eye named Burke. Vax's third Burke novel has just been published by Knopf. It's called Blue Bell. Before writing fiction and starting his law career, Vax worked as a public health investigator, tracking the spread of venereal diseases, and he ran a maximum security institution for juvenile offenders. Vax's crusade against child abusers led him to start writing crime novels.
Well, I'd done a considerable amount of writing for professional journals and even for magazines about the same themes, and it became clear to me that if I wanted to reach the size audience that I believe needed to be reached with this material, I needed to find another format. And this was the only one that's really available to somebody who's not rich. I couldn't very well go out and make my own movies.
I want you to describe Burke, the main character in your novels.
Burke is a practicing criminal who's an urban survival expert and is good at only that, basically a failure at everything else. Formerly a violent criminal who would like to live nonviolently and still survive, and whose life problem is constantly being sucked back into violence.
But he's frequently violent on the side of the good guys.
I don't know, frequently. And Burke's not a white knight, and he's not anybody's idea of a contemporary hero, but he does have a hard spot in his heart for child molesters, and that does cause continuing problems in his life, yeah.
To get a sense of the setting of the book, and the setting is New York, I'd like you to do a short reading from the beginning of the book, which describes describes something of part of the neighborhood that this is set in.
Okay. Let's see. People have always lived down here. The neighborhood used to be a damned art colony. It produced more pottery than the whole Navajo Nation. The hippies and the artists thought the winos added just the right touch of realism to their lives. But the new occupants are the kind who get pre-orgasmic when you whisper investment banking, and they didn't much care for the local color. Locksmiths were riding the crest of a growth industry. The Superior Hotel entrance was around the corner on Chamber Street, with rooms extending all along West Broadway. Mine was on the top floor, facing out over the park. $75 a week bought me a swayback single bed and an iron frame, a ratty old easy chair worn down to the cotton padding on the arms, and a metal closet standing against the wall. The room was painted in some kind of neutral-colored stuff that was about half disinfectant. A heavy length of vinyl-wrapped chain stood against the wall, anchored at one end to U-bolts driven into the floor. The other end stood open, padlocked to nothing, waiting patiently. I hadn't gone for the optional TV at only $2 a day. Someone who had never lived in one might say the room looked like a prison cell. It didn't come close.
Yeah, and Burke, who's narrating there, used to be a convict.
Yeah.
He's an ex-con. Now, this is a guy who's a criminal who works against child molesters, but is not a licensed private investigator by any means. You work in the system as a lawyer working against child abuse. Do you see him as an alter ego in any way?
No, I really don't. I see him as a tour guide through a significant piece of hell, and I think that one has to be qualified to be a guide. I don't think that a tourist would be a good one to show people around.
Do you ever wish you could take the law into your hands the way he does?
Everybody wishes they could take the law into their hands once in a while. I don't think Burke's a particularly effective person and wouldn't want to emulate him.
One of his friends is someone who's nicknamed the Professor, and he speaks in rhymes, and he says, cutting up slime ain't no crime. What do you think of that attitude?
I think that's his attitude. I don't think it's an uncommon attitude among a class of criminals that seems to be disappearing. My contemporaries, people my age, had that attitude. I'm not so sure it's a contemporary attitude.
As part of your work now, do you have to go to the kinds of sex parlors and strip joints that so much of your book is set in?
I have to go a lot of places that I wouldn't choose to go if it were my own choice. Not too often a strip joint, not anywhere near as much as I did when I was working in other capacities, but certainly I have to go to places where children or pictures of children are bought and sold and trafficked in.
Burke, the main character in your book, says that there's no more outlaw code, that there's no rules for freaks. Do you think that things have changed in the criminal world, that the freaks that you're writing about are different than, say, the gangsters or the criminals of earlier times?
I don't think there's any question about it. I also think that the criminal subculture perception of child molesters has changed radically. It's a common treasured delusion of liberals that child molesters are very harshly dealt with in prison. And that's just not true. It would be impossible 20, 30 years ago to survive in prison if you were known to be an informant. That's not the case today either.
You know, I want to ask you something else about writing detective fiction.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of crime novels, it seems that the detective or the cop recognizes something of themselves in the criminal who they're tracking. And part of the tension in the novel comes from the sense of the criminal almost being the secret sharer of the cop or the detective. And I wonder if you ever feel you have that kind of relationship with the characters who you write about.
I don't know, because it's a little more complex than that. In this book, of course, there is a relationship between a cop and a criminal. But that relationship is based on past conduct, and it ends up being, to some extent, betrayed during the book. I myself don't feel a relationship between characters so much as what the characters do. That's specifically what I would relate to.
You're really no prude in terms of sex or violence in the writing of your book. Do you ever think that that might work against you in court? Might that be a problem?
No, I don't think so. I think that it's a common misperception that people will read a novel and assume that everything that's in the novel is a reflection of the author's particular individual lifestyle. But my work is very specialized, very hardcore work, and I haven't found any of this stuff impacting on it in any realistic way. People have read the books, and they'll say that they've read the books, and they like them or they hate them. But it doesn't seem to have influenced any verdicts that I can tell.
My guest is Andrew Vax, who is a lawyer in New York specializing in child abuse cases. He's also a crime novelist, and his new novel is titled Bluebell. It's just been published by Knopf. One of the things that you did before you became a lawyer was to direct a maximum security facility for juvenile offenders who were aggressive or violent. Were there any changes that you made in the facility while you ran it?
Yeah, there were the most dramatic changes possible.
What'd you do?
Well, I can sum it up for you very simply. When the prison was under control and running at least partly the way we wanted, there were no suicide attempts, there were no stabbings, there were no homosexual attacks. If you ask anybody who's run a maximum security institution, they'll tell you that in and of itself is remarkable.
What did you do to get those results?
That would take longer than this program, but essentially we explained very clearly and graphically to the prisoners that they were not going to run the institution, that we were, and that they could choose the level of violence necessary to make their behavior proper, from none to a lot, depending on how they behaved.
Did you feel that the offenders had been running it before, had been running the prison? Is it a prison? Is that the right word?
Yeah, it was okay. A prison, and the offenders were certainly running it.
Mm-hmm.
When we took it over, there had been an attempted rape of a staff member. There had been numerous escapes. There had been horrible violence. There had been a small core group of inmates that were clearly in charge and were calling all the shots.
So how did you take the control out of their hands?
In some cases, physically, and in some cases by changing the nonsensical subculture that existed. They'd run it on sort of this token economy system, like you might in a sheltered workshop, where you got points for certain kinds of conduct. And we found, of course, that the worst behaved inmates had all the points for the best behavior because the staff were just frankly afraid of them.
So you got rid of that whole system?
And that whole staff, yeah.
How did working in a prison for juvenile offenders lead to your work with children who are victims of sexual abuse?
Well, many of the kids that were in there fit that category quite well. When I did sort of a half-baked, non-academic survey, I'd asked all the kids if they'd been abused, and they uniformly said no. And so I got one kid who'd come in there with half his face being scar tissue and cigarette butts burnt out on his arms. How he could say he hadn't been abused, he told me that his mother had chopped off his little brother's hand, so he figured that was abuse, and he hadn't been. It became pretty apparent to me, and then and now I'm absolutely certain of it, that there's no such thing as a biogenetic mutation that causes lifestyle criminality, that it's an environmental issue. And what I was living with was the hardcore precipitate from long-term chronic child abuse.
So you found that a lot of the prisoners had been the victims of child abuse?
Oh, yeah. Almost uniformly.
When you were working as the director of that prison, did it convince you that people who had become criminals could be redeemed, or did it convince you of the hopelessness of trying?
What it convinced me of was there's a direct correlation between the speed and the earliness with which you intervene and the result. The later you try, the worse your chance of success. And don't forget, even though I had a prison full of people who'd committed the worst crimes, homicides, rapes, armed robberies, they were young people, 16, 17, 18 years old. I would venture to say that those same people left in that same state at 35 would be close to unredeemable.
So was your idea to start working with children who are much younger before they got to the point of committing those crimes?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In order to make any kind of an impact, instead of reforming juvenile corrections, I was hoping to remove a significant number of the candidates for juvenile corrections.
Now, how does it work when you're a lawyer defending children? The child can't go and hire you.
No. Well, that depends, actually. I have been hired by teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
But if you mean a small child, of course not. The way it works in New York State is this. The state recognizes there are three interests in a child abuse trial. There's the state interest, there's the accused's interest, and there's the child's interest. And so children are automatically given separate independent counsel in a child protective proceeding, and you're appointed by the court.
When you are appointed and you are representing a child, if they are the victim of sexual abuse, how do you get the child to tell you what happened?
It's generally not difficult, but most children speak through their behavior rather than through their words. I interviewed a five-year-old girl who, was led into the room, and the social worker said, "This is your lawyer," and she climbed to my lap and grabbed my genitals. I didn't need to have a big diagnostic workup to figure out this child had been abused.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I don't work alone or independently. There's a team of people, including some very skilled clinical personnel, who can do the diagnostic interviews if they're required.
So
and sometimes the evidence is so physically graphic that nobody needs further interviews.
This instance that you just mentioned where you invited a child on your lap and they grabbed your genitals,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that really shows what they'd been trained to do. Did you have a long talk with the child afterwards to explain that?
I mean,
how do you deal with that?
Well, the way I dealt with that was I'm describing something that happened the first time, and I was shocked and pulled the kid away and said, "What are you doing?" And the child looked at me and said, "You're a daddy, right? All daddies like that." And I tried my best to explain and saw that it was not an explanation that could be delivered in one sitting. And that child was referred to a very skillful therapist and is still in therapy even as we speak. It's been years.
When you're dealing with a young child, do they know the difference between a therapist and a lawyer and what the appropriate behavior is with each?
It depends on the age of the child, the child's intellect, the degree of abuse the child has suffered. Some certainly do.
Does it matter? I mean, should they behave differently with you, their lawyer, than they should with their therapist?
Well, only to the extent that we have different ends. If I'm preparing a child to testify, there's certain behavior and certain responses that I need that may be very different from what a therapist needs. A therapist might encourage a child to just go berserk, to just let it all out, to scream for an hour straight if that's what's needed. That wouldn't be what I'd need during testimony, for example. But we are all part of the same team, so the behavior doesn't need to be different. The one thing that's told the child all the time is you're safe with us, and as long as the child trusts that, the behavior tends to be about the same.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your work as a lawyer and also about your fiction, but first we're going to take a short break. Andrew Vax is my guest. He's a lawyer in New York specializing in child abuse cases. He's also a crime novelist, and his third novel has just been published. It's called Bluebell. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Lawyer and crime novelist Andrew Vax is my guest. When you're representing a child, is it your job frequently to try to get them away from their parents?
Yes, it is.
What do you think of the alternatives to that? Would it be an institution for most of the children?
Certainly not any kid I represent, unless the kid is so melted down or so flagrantly psychotic that a foster home is impossible. I wouldn't ever go along with institutionalizing a child as an alternative to removal if the child's capable of even passably functioning in a foster care setting.
Do you get the feeling that in recent years there's been a rise in incest, child abuse, pedophilia?
No. I do think that because the media, which ends up being really the only force for social change in this country, having focused on it, there's a lot more reporting of what has always existed. I don't feel that the incidents themselves have increased.
What are some of the difficulties you feel you're up against as a lawyer trying to get convictions?
Well, one of the difficulties, of course, is judges, juries, citizens have trouble crediting their senses when they hear the accounts. They simply say this stuff can't be happening. And there's a denial mechanism, not unlike the denial mechanism that a victim goes through, that the public goes through. And that's one great difficulty. Another thing is that children don't make the world's greatest witnesses, especially very, very young children. And another difficulty is that much of the abuse doesn't leave a trail, such as physical abuse would leave. These are all things that have to be overcome.
Do you ever use unorthodox techniques to overcome those challenges?
I don't know. I think when we started, they were unorthodox. I don't think they're unorthodox anymore. Now it's become common for lawyers who represent kids to take the kid into the courtroom days before the trial starts and familiarize the child with the courtroom setting and even play some of the roles and use little tricks like telling the child that when a defense attorney screams and yells at you, that means he's afraid. And that's, of course, an energizing, empowering thing for the child who's previously been attacked. But I don't know what's left that's unorthodox. We use a system of the only way to characterize it is voluntary informants. I get lots and lots of information from people that I've never met and probably never will meet. But this isn't so much a method as what's happened over the course of the years.
Have you also defended children who've been involved in kiddie porn rings?
I've never defended them because they haven't been attacked. Once I've defended their interests.
That's what I meant. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, yeah. The reason I make that distinction is I do defend children who are accused of crimes.
Right, right.
But I've never had to defend a kid who's been involved in kiddie porn, even when the kid's been an active recruiter, because it's pretty clear, even to the authorities, that this is pretty much Stockholm Syndrome, and a child that was coerced to the point where his mind was taken over. Nobody really wants to prosecute an 11-year-old who's recruiting 8-year-olds.
Right. What are some of the ways children are recruited into that trade?
Well, the easiest way is simply to appeal to what children like. I mean, every card-carrying pedophile has a nice collection of toys and video games and good food and lots of time to spend with a kid. Many of these kids no one spends time with at all. And someone who shows this kind of incredible, intense interest that really only a pedophile could show. This almost obsessive desire to be with the kid every minute and to lavish every bit of attention on him is extremely seductive. And then there's a desensitization process, which usually begins with the gradual introduction of pornography. This is a way of showing the kid that everybody does these things and they're perfectly okay and acceptable. And the pedophile picks carefully and he'll make an initial probe. And unless he gets the right response, many of them will withdraw at that point.
Is there a syndrome of children who've been abused at home, running away from home to get away from their parents and then ending up in pornography?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, interview any prostitute out there under 16 years of age, and the odds are overwhelming that you'll find them running away from a horribly abusive environment. I remember one little girl that I took out of Times Square when I was taking her to the airport, and she had really been worked over very badly in her so-called profession. We were talking about running away, and I was talking, you know, like about Huck Finn. I talked about running away for a sense of adventure, and she just didn't pay any attention. And I said, it seemed to me that people run away to get to a better place, and she looked me in the eye then and said, I did. To both.
Hmm.
So, and was quite clear that she'd return to the streets the second she got the opportunity.
You know, as I think I pointed out before, the characters in your novel are totally outside the system, except for a couple of cops in it. But the main character works totally outside the system. You work in the system as a lawyer. Are you satisfied with the results you get working through the system, or do you ever get really frustrated with the system and fantasize about working outside of it?
I actually never fantasize about working outside of it in the way that these characters do, because they're not really effective at what they do. People die, and individuals may get rescued or may not. But in terms of systemic change, it's not something these characters even contemplate. Anyone who doesn't get frustrated with the system isn't battling it as I am. But I don't feel I'm so much working within the system as working to change it. And it has changed.
What do you want to change within the system?
Oh, God, unless you had a four-hour program, it would be impossible even to touch on it. But essentially, what I'd like to see is this system recognize that today's victim is tomorrow's predator, and that there's a direct causal connection between today's abused child and the beasts that will frighten us so much 10, 15 years from now. We don't have any national agenda about child abuse. We just have a lot of speeches. And if we invested even a portion of the money that we now invest in impossible dreams like interdicting narcotics on the coastline, we could see a really substantial change in the quality of life in this country.
So you'd like to see more, if you had your way, there wouldn't be confidentiality on child abuse cases?
There'd be limited confidentiality. I see no reason to keep the proceedings secret from the public, because the public largely believes that these cases don't happen. They believe people beat up their kids, but the idea of sexually abusing one's own child still is certainly foreign to most Americans.
I'm wondering if part of what you're trying to do is to shock the public into recognition of what's happening through your fiction. And I'm thinking there's a scene in your new novel where one character says to Burke, tell me the worst thing that you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, baby parts, that there's a whole black market in not only selling babies, but in taking some of the babies and kind of chopping them up for parts. So if a heart transplant is needed, you could sell the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Or the kidney.
Mm-hmm. Well, the goal is not simply to shock people, which I think in and of itself does nothing, but to make people angry. The American public is this great slumbering beast that's incredibly powerful, but sleeps most of the time. But when energized, it's an awesome force. I think simply shocking people is useless. I think if people don't feel that they can do something about it, they won't. There are many things that could be done. Just off the top of my head, in New York State, incest is the lowest class felony possible. It's an automatic probation-eligible offense. It's lumped, if you look in the penal law, right next to adultery. It shouldn't be so. Incest is rape by extortion, and it should be penalized like any other rape. There shouldn't be immunity or special treatment for criminals who grow their own victims.
I want to ask you a couple of questions about scams, only because you seem to know so much about them in your book. You've got, really, I have to say, a great variety of scams. Is this just from being a resident of New York, or have you gone out of your way to research some of these scams?
I've not researched them. I've been exposed to them. I don't know how you'd research them. I mean,
I don't know.
I don't see them written down anyplace.
Right.
But...
Well, tell us about a couple of the mail order scams that you have Burke doing.
Well, the essence of all Burke's scams are to sting people who can't sting back. So Burke would not do a mail order scam where he was promising people land in Florida that he didn't possess. That'll last only a few weeks before the attorney general moves in on you. What Burke does is target people who, for example, who collect kiddie pornography and not deliver it, and they can't hardly complain. Burke targets people who fancy themselves mercenaries, and so he sells them information on joining mercenary armies which don't exist. Again, you have a group of people that can't complain. That's the kind of work that he wants to do and the kind of work he'd rather stay with if he could.
Do you know people doing those scams?
I know of such scams being done.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Through pictures of you, I should preface this question by saying that you're speaking to us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. And so we are not in the same room together, but through pictures of you, I've seen that you wear an eye patch over one eye, and I guess you're blind in one eye. Some people prefer to use a glass eye or something like that, and I was wondering if your choice of using a patch has anything to do with appearances. And I think what I mean by that is, since your work sometimes takes you to some pretty tough places, maybe you'd look more tough yourself with the eye patch.
Well, that's really wrong on both counts.
And okay.
I'll explain to you.
Please.
The first thing is I'm not blind in the eye. The eye is badly damaged, the muscle wall between the two eyes has been torn and restitched numerous times, so it wouldn't work binocularly. The eye is patched off because if light hits it, I get a strobing effect, so I'm constantly nauseous. However, it does work enough. It's not correctable so that I could ever read with it or drive a car, but it does work enough so that it would be insane to destroy it. It's a valuable spare part, since I've only got one left.
I see.
And the second thing is that an eye patch may look, I don't know, tough in a picture, but the places I have to work, any impediment is more likely to get people to attack you, not less.
Right, because people are watching for your vulnerabilities.
Sure.
And looking to take advantage of them.
Sure.
Right. Okay, well, I hope you didn't mind me asking.
No, not at all. I mean, I understand that it could be a lot of confusion about it, and it's not normally something I discuss, but the patch has got a functional purpose, and I've had surgery on my face numerous times. I'm not giving up, and I hope someday I don't have to wear the damn thing anymore.
Good, yeah, that'd be great. Well, listen, thank you very, very much for talking with us about your writing and about your work as a lawyer. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andrew Vax has been my guest, and he's a lawyer who specializes in child abuse cases working in New York City. He's also a crime novelist, and his new novel, Bluebell, has just been published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with journalist Robert Lindsay, who wrote the book The Falcon and the Snowman, which covered the case of Christopher Boyce, an American who sold classified secrets to the Soviet Union. Lindsay's new book, A Gathering of Saints, tells the story of the murder of two Mormons in Salt Lake City, Utah, in 1985. Lindsay's book reveals a master forger's attempt to discredit and destroy the Mormon Church. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Malcolm McLaren has been called the Svengali of rock and London's Andy Warhol. That was back in the 70s when he created the punk band The Sex Pistols. Now the new Museum of Contemporary Art is calling McLaren impresario in a new exhibit that covers McLaren's work in rock and fashion. Coming up, we meet Malcolm McLaren. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the career of one of rock's oddest stars, Captain Beefheart. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Great Divide, the latest collection of Studs Terkel's interviews, examining what's happened to the American dream of social justice in the Reagan era. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Firefighters in Vacaville, California, are hoping tonight to control a wind-driven wildfire raging through an area 50 miles northeast of San Francisco. Kevin Guillory of member station KQED has details.
The hills above Vacaville are on fire. So far, 8 homes have been lost, with 20,000 acres enveloped by the flames. The terrain here is steep and inaccessible, so firefighters are trying to contain it by clearing a fire line all along its eastern front. Air tankers and helicopters are dumping thousands of gallons of water on the fire line, hoping to stop its spread. California Department of Forestry spokesman John Ferrer said the winds that prevented crews from getting a handle on this fire yesterday are back.
The winds originally were predicted at 15 to 20 miles an hour out of the northwest. That's already been changed to 15 to 20 miles an hour out of the northeast, with gusts up to 40 miles per hour. And any time we get gusts up that high, we begin to get concerned.
Vacaville itself is not in the line of fire. A 6-lane freeway separates the town proper from the hills where the fire is. But officials say they're still concerned. There are dozens of homes scattered throughout these hills. For National Public Radio, this is Kevin Guillory reporting from Vacaville, California.
George Bush visited a flag factory in New Jersey today, where he promised that his election to the presidency would usher in a new era of greatness for the United States. Meanwhile, Michael Dukakis offered details of his proposed health insurance program during a campaign stop today in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Tim England of member station WKYU has the story.
The Democratic presidential candidate unveiled his health insurance program at Western Kentucky University before a crowd of faculty and students and healthcare professionals. The first part of his plan is to provide a basic level of health insurance for all workers. Dukakis wants all employers, with a few exceptions for small businesses, to provide basic health coverage. He said his father, who was a doctor, would have agreed.
We're going to make sure that when Americans get sick, the first question they hear will be the question my father used to ask, the question that doctors and nurses ask every day, not how can you pay, but where does it hurt?
Dukakis also said he wanted to extend health insurance to the unemployed. He said if elected, he would name a task force whose job it would be to draw up a plan to have every American properly insured. For National Public Radio, I'm Tim England, Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Independent counsel Lawrence Walsh today filed a motion to dismiss charges against a former CIA agent accused of illegally helping arm the Nicaraguan rebels. But the Iran-Contra prosecutor says he will refile the charges in another court. Walsh said he was dropping the 5-count indictment against Joseph Fernandez because 4 of the 5 alleged offenses occurred in Northern Virginia. Fernandez headed the CIA station in Costa Rica. He was indicted in June on charges that he participated in an illegal conspiracy with former National Security aide Oliver North and arms dealer Richard Secord to arm the Contras. The government said today economic growth was strong in the second quarter, but inflation was higher than previously expected. The Commerce Department said the gross national product grew at a rate of 3% from April to June. If not for the drought, second quarter growth would have been 3.9%. Crop and livestock losses for the year are estimated at about $14 billion. Analysts say the summer's dry weather will be even more of a drag on the economy in the third and fourth quarters. Inflation, as measured by the GNP deflator, rose 5.5% in the second quarter. It was the biggest jump in that indicator since the third quarter of 1982. Stock prices were slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 6 points to close at 2087.48. Advances led declines 7-5 on volume of 142 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Captain Beefheart is one of rock's great eccentrics. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward delves into the life and times of Captain Beefheart.
I want to find me a woman to hold my big toe until I have to go. I want to find me a blue swim plastic ocarina about 5 miles long. Play with them sweet potatoes all night long.
There are some people who say that today's music has just gotten too weird, too far from its roots, too out of touch with its audience to be considered truly popular. These are usually the people who are trying to justify not having listened to anything new since Jim Morrison died, but that's another story. The point I'm trying to make is that ever since the 60s, rock and roll has had a place for experimenters. And although, like in any avant-garde, a lot of it's junk, occasionally there are geniuses whose influence can be felt even when their records barely sell. That's the case with Don Van Vliet, better known to history as Captain Beefheart. Without his weird vocals and bizarre approach to rhythm, a lot of today's scene, from Tom Waits to heavy metal, would sound a lot different. Don Van Vliet was a child art prodigy who was discovered at the age of 4 by a prominent sculptor. For the next 9 years, his fanciful sculpted animals appeared on an L.A. TV art show, and when he was 13, he was offered a full scholarship to study art in Europe. His parents, equating art school with homosexuality, immediately moved to Lancaster in the middle of the Mojave Desert, where young Don met a kid named Frank Zappa and turned to the more manly art of rock and roll. Throughout the late 50s and early 60s, Frank and Don played in bands, but in 1963, they went their separate ways, and Don moved back to Lancaster to start the Magic Band. He cut Diddy Wah Diddy while under contract to A&M Records, who let him go because they thought he was too weird for 1964. Too weird? With Don's young guitar discovery, Ryland P. Cooter, playing great blues? But he stuck with it, and in 1967 unleashed Safe as Milk, an album that truly struck terror into the hearts of those who heard it. Songs like Zigzag Wanderer sound pretty tame today, and in fact, Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band were pretty hot on the Fillmore Ballroom circuit. But again, nobody could figure it out. After getting burned by a couple of record labels and feeling burned out, Don moved back to the desert to paint. But one day in 1969, the phone rang, and Frank Zappa, now a star with his own record label to play with, asked Don if he'd like to record again. He must have. He wrote 28 songs in 8.5 hours and found a new band to work with. He taught them the songs note by note and, in fact, preferred people with no musical experience. You may think, it sure sounds that way, but there's definitely an intelligence at work on the masterpiece that followed, a double album called Trout Mask Replica.
A squid eating dough in a polyethylene bag is fast and bulbous. Got me?
The music was still blues, but blues that had fallen apart and been put together again by somebody clumsy, or an artist. The titles were poetry all by themselves. Pachuco Cadaver, which we just heard, When Big Jones Sets Up, Hobo Changba, Neon Meat Dream of an Octafish. He recorded the vocal to The Blimp over the phone because he was scared of what it might do to the trees at Zappa's studio.
You ready?
Frank, it's the big hit. It's the blimp. It's the blimp, Frank. It's the blimp. Right.
Langdon Winter, one of Rolling Stone's most erudite critics, pronounced it a masterpiece, and it sold respectably enough to give birth to a sequel, Lick My Decals Off, Baby.
Rather than I wanna hold your hair, I wanna swallow your whole.
Zappa's record company dissolved in a flurry of lawsuits, but Beefheart had gotten his message out. He continued to make records, and once, when his record company told him he was too uncommercial, he recorded this.
I got too much time. Too much time. I got too much time to be without love. Too much time. I got too much time. I got too much time. Too much time to be without love.
But mostly his stuff isn't such easy listening. His most recent album, Ice Cream for Crow, was recorded in 1982. And he's back in the desert now, painting more of his wonderful canvases. I think that, along with many people, I can say that Captain Beefheart changed the way I listen to things. And if his work isn't for everyone, it's essential to understanding why today's music sounds like it does.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
I want to kill my China pig. A man's gotta live, a man's gotta eat, a man's gotta have shoes to walk out on the street. I don't want to kill my China pig.
This is Fresh Air. In the mid-70s, the Sex Pistols epitomized the anti-establishment, intentionally offensive attitude of British punk rock.
God save the Queen! The fascist regime! They made you a moron! Potential hate bomb! God save the Queen! She ain't no human being!
The man who formed and managed the Sex Pistols was Malcolm McLaren. At the time, he owned a trendy clothing store in London called Sex. McLaren's life as a rock promoter, musician, fashion designer, and conceptual artist is the subject of a retrospective exhibit at the New Museum for Contemporary Art in New York. McLaren has often been accused of being a manipulator of the culture, but he sees himself more as an agent provocateur.
Most of the work that I've ever tried to initiate has always been from the standpoint of in the making of records and working with popular imagery such as groups and fashion and working in medias of that sort. The whole reason for my existence in that is through the nature of provocation.
What do you mean by provocation?
Well, make the ideas meet a challenge, make the ideas exact the opposite feeling to what ordinary people would normally feel when they listen to a pop record. I'd rather have them jump out of their chair and destroy the radio that they're listening to. The nature of working in those mediums after leaving art school was one which intrigued me because it had become apparent by the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s that the media seemed to be such a major instrument in controlling the general cultural flow that the idea of painting in an attic, as I was taught to do for 8 years in art school, seemed the wrong process. And I decided to use people like sculptors use clay.
You first became known in England for a clothing shop that you ran, which for most...
That was the starting point after leaving art school, you know. It was a place to basically earn a living from, and being a very Fagin-esque kind of character, I decided to sort of manipulate the situation by basically selling old radios as new radios, by selling, I suppose, old books as new books, by selling old clothes as new clothes. It was a kind of a, it was an oasis at the time in the King's Road, which was very well known for being a velveted, loon-panted, dandyish street for pop fashion. And when I meant to talk about provocation before, the clothes that developed were clothes that I had to sell, which I thought would label the word sex and be sexy in a very clear and instructive manner. And the only way I thought I could really do that was to look at clothes that had a fetish nature.
But like what? Like leather
like,
clothes?
Yeah, like rubber T-shirts, mm-hmm. rubber lingerie, T-shirts that suddenly I would print on a variety of voyeuristic slogans from well-known authors in England, like Alexander Trokey, who was like our equivalent to, I suppose, your William Burroughs. Suddenly I found myself with a group of fans of David Bowie or Rod Stewart or Mark Bolan or Mick Jagger, all descending upon my store, because these clothes suddenly struck a chord in their heart, which was one of being considered anti. You know, in other words, you didn't walk in step with the fellow in front of you. You walked in a different way. You had a different look.
Your greatest success musically was putting together the band The Sex Pistols and packaging them. What was your concept when you first thought it up?
How to make a living out of all these kids that were thieving in my store, to tell you the truth. I don't think it was much further than that, except I was inspired by the fact that they were ingenious at thieving a great deal of equipment in the beginning. I knew it couldn't have come from the pockets of themselves. It had to have been stolen from the likes of David Bowie, etc., who, in fact, in the end, I understood, was one of the people who owned a variety of equipment that the Sex Pistols ultimately played. It was always a scary thing, I think, for them to go on stage with all this equipment, because it was terrifying to think that there was some roadie in the audience that would recognize the particular guitar or amplifier.
You've called the Sex Pistols the great rock and roll swindle. In what way was it a swindle? What was the swindle?
It really was about swindling your way to the top of a record industry, which is really founded on a great deal of hype and sensational advertising and a tremendous amount of maneuvering with the likes that be in this kind of world we live in. It was a way of doing it, but upstaging it and doing it without necessarily the record company, but doing it by your own will. It was a swindling by the purpose of really deciding not to play, really deciding sometimes not to even give out a record, really by deciding not to even be played on the radio. We did that with one record, God Save the Queen, which I think probably stood the record of the only record that reached the number one in the charts without any airplay, without seeing the group, and in many instances without even being able to buy it in most of the main chain stores. And yet, within 1 week, became the number one record. It didn't matter that you couldn't hear it. It was the attitude.
Well, part of the attitude that the Sex Pistols had was to destroy things, to show no respect even for the record company people who were giving them money.
Yeah, to be like gods, really.
Did you encourage them to do that?
Oh, always. I think that the idea for me, you know, pop stars were only extraordinary if they were really mythical, and I think that I tried to make the Sex Pistols as mythical as possible. When I finally came to work on my own music, it was something that I discovered was so similar to what operatic characters are. You know, they're equally mythological beings, and they're totally immortal, they're totally irresponsible. There's nobody more irresponsible in the world of popular culture, including opera, than Don Giovanni, far more than Mick Jagger or Johnny Rotten or Sid Vicious or Boy George put together. That's really what I was trying to say, and I think that's what the Sex Pistols became. They were very operatic, really.
In some ways, you see the Sex Pistols as being this success in packaging and in image and in manipulation. But I think what that doesn't take into account is that they were a good band. I mean, some of their
ultimately,
records were really, really good.
But that's nothing you ever want to admit, because being good is not the idea. Being bad is what's more exciting, you see.
Yeah, but I mean, how much of their success do you think had to do with the fact that they were doing good stuff? I mean, and beyond the packaging.
I think that was the final icing on the cake, and I think it was the thing that ultimately they played with credibility. I don't think they were playing to sell a record. They were playing for reasons that they had something to say. It's a rare incident today that you'll find that in many groups.
Does it ever get tiring always looking for a new trend to start, as opposed to having some kind of craft that you could just continue with?
Yeah, I wish I'd have stayed sometimes painting, but I'm afraid I was an art student in the late 60s and the whole global village and multimedia explosion, and having walked into an art gallery and seen an Andy Warhol exhibition at the age of 18 kind of completely changed me. He was quite responsible, I think, of me thinking of art as business, with his famous quote that art, good art is good business and bad art is bad. That really just threw me in a spin and took me down a road that I still don't think I've finished yet, you know. That was a policy, I think, that was inspiring a great deal of my fellow students at the time. And we all crossed over into all these other areas. I never thought I'd end up in music. I still can't play a single note. And most people think I sing flat. But what can you say? You know, it's the job I seem to be making work.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
The exhibit Impresario, Malcolm McLaren and the British New Wave is at the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York until November 20th. From one of McLaren's own records, this is his interpretation of Carmen. 40 seconds. Carmen's an animal, uncontrollable stuff. This is Fresh Air. Renee Montaigne, the co-host of All Things Considered, is joining us to tell us what's coming up tonight on All Things Considered. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
Do you have campaign stories for us today?
Well, we do indeed. Democratic candidate Michael Dukakis is in Kentucky today, and he offered details on his national health plan. It would require most employers, with the exception of some small businesses, to provide health insurance to their employees. The Republican candidate, meanwhile, is still on the subject of patriotism and what it means to be an American. George Bush visited the country's oldest flag factory in New Jersey today. He said it was the symbol of the nation's economic and spiritual revival. We also take a look at the origin of the Pledge of Allegiance. It turns out that a prominent socialist in the late 19th century came up with the idea of the pledge.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Great Divide is a new collection of contemporary American oral histories collected by Studs Terkel. Terkel has chronicled the lives of his compatriots for over 40 years. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Terkel's new book.
Studs Terkel is the opposite of a public opinion poll. He goes everywhere, but when he gets there, he stays put long enough to let people explain themselves. Think of him as Walt Whitman with a tape recorder. The people he records, among them school teachers in the ghetto, airline flight attendants, stockbrokers, farmers, dentists, teamsters, ad copywriters and juice bar cashiers, steel workers, firefighters, priests and disc jockeys, Gray Panthers and neo-Nazis, cement masons and gay activists, a congressman, a novelist, and a cop. These people listen to themselves as they tell their story into the microphone. They have arrived at what they think through the work they've done, which they describe in detail. The brain, after all, is a muscle. They flex and weave a pattern and admit ambivalence and end up confiding their dreams and disappointments with a shapeliness that's almost art. It takes, of course, a Terkel to hear them. He's been listening for years, hitting the road out of Chicago, coming back with books of conversations like Division Street America, Hard Times, Working, Talking to Myself, and American Dreams Lost and Found. For The Good War, an oral history of World War II, he won a Pulitzer Prize. If you only know him from radio or his books, you can see what he looks like in the nifty new John Sayles movie about the Chicago Black Sox, Eight Men Out, where he impersonates a sports writer, a hard-boiled leprechaun. He seeks in the Great Divide for whatever happened to the American dream of social justice after the Reagan years. He finds yuppies and religious fundamentalists, social parasites and burnt-out cases, couch potatoes and nippins, neat young people in neat situations is the translation. He finds states of mind like greed and doubt, anger and despair. And he finds absence of memory. It's as if the whole nation had forgotten the Depression and never heard of the Civil War and never read the Bill of Rights. The Great Divide is the past we've lost when we were a caring country. But because he's Terkel, the radical optimist, he keeps on looking until he also finds pockets of resistance and renewal, organizers of union locals and community action groups, teachers who won't quit, and doctors committed to low-cost health care clinics, and police chiefs who know something about the social pathology of crime, and a sanctuary movement for refugees from Latin American death squads. These voices mass in his book to a choral movement of energy and dissent, a decency on the march. Jean Gump, the grandmother who went to prison for 8 years to slow down the deployment of nuclear missiles, tells Terkel, quote, "As inmates, we're property. We belong to Mr. Meese. We belong to the Bureau of Prisons. A month ago, a young woman had come here from another federal institution. She'd been locked up for 14 months without seeing the light of day. On arriving here, she was so happy to be out in the sunlight, she lay down and got herself a sunburn. They wrote a shot. That's an incident report. The shot read, 'Destruction of government property.' The property was her skin, which she had burned. Think about it. According to Terkel, it's time that we worked on our tans."
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Studs Terkel's new book, The Great Divide. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I speak with actress Sylvia Miles. She starred in the Paul Morrissey, Andy Warhol film Heat and won an Academy Award nomination for her performance in Midnight Cowboy. Now she plays the matchmaker in the new film Crossing Delancey. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of love songs performed by Arlene Auger and pianist Dalton Baldwin, both Americans who have a wide following in Europe. And book critic Stuart Klawans reviews The Hungry Girls. It's a collection of contemporary animal fables by Patricia Eakins. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.